On the show Brain Games, they were illustrating this herd mentality that is true of people, of humans. We have this tendency to act in ways that just try to fit in with the herd. And it showed that by, it illustrated that by having this line of people, and they were all supposed to look at two signs. On these two signs, you had one sign had three different lines that were different sizes, and they were labeled A, B, and C. And then there was another sign that had a line, and it matched very clearly one of those lines. And the first person in line got up, and they said, well, that line matches A. Next person gets up and says, it's A. Next person says A, and it's on and on and on. They're all saying A until you get to the last person who's standing there, and they're looking at the sign. What you don't realize is that if you were to look, well, you can, if you were watching this, you would have seen the answer is clearly not A. The answer is clearly C. And what's going on behind the scenes is everybody is a part of the show except for that last person. They go through and they all answer A. And you could see a lot of the people that were at the last in the line, they knew that it was C, but they started to doubt themselves. Some of them really thought they must be wrong, but most of them chose A. Even though it was obvious, it's C. They chose A because they doubted themselves. They went with the group. They melted under the pressure. And they even thought that they must be wrong in some cases. It was only those really confident people that were saying, no, I don't care what everybody else said, that's C. They had the confidence to go against the flow. Now, what do you think could happen in that scenario if you were to tell the last person in line, okay, this is the deal. The group is going to say the wrong answer. They're going to say the wrong answer. You need to stand your ground. You need to say the right answer. And in the end, everybody's going to see that you were right. It would probably only help if the person believed you. I mean, because you still feel that pressure, right? You have to actually believe what somebody is telling you in order for it to make a difference. And that's the situation we're in as Christians. Everybody around us is telling us different things. And what Christianity says is that in the end, it will be seen that we were right to follow Christ. It's not an I told you so kind of moment. It's a reality that you need to keep going because in the end, you don't want to be a part of the group that's wrong. You want to be faithful and respond not A when everybody's saying A, but C, even if nobody agrees with you because the Bible says C. That's the kind of attitude that we need to have. We need to have confidence. And one of the ways that the Spirit gives us confidence is by telling us in the Word what's going to happen in the end. That in the end, it's going to be revealed. Everybody's going to see the truth. Every knee is going to bow. And because of that, it's meant to give us confidence to keep going now, to keep doing what we need to now. This morning, we're going to be in Micah chapter 7. Looking at verses 8 and 13, and in those verses, it gives us four different aspects of salvation and judgment. And those aspects are supposed to give us confidence. So we need to, one, believe what the Word says and have confidence that these things are true. And that confidence in what the Word is telling us about salvation and judgment in the end, that's going to give us confidence in how we behave now. So it matters. Listening about, hearing about our future is going to help us be confident right now. So you look at those verses, chapter 7. The first aspect is seen in verses 8 and 9. And it's telling us that we need to be confident. We must be confident in salvation through judgment. That's what we see there in those first two verses. It says, rejoice not over me, O my enemy. When I fall, I shall rise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he pleads my cause and executes judgment for me. He will bring me out to the light. I shall look upon his vindication. As with all these prophecies, it's hard to tell when Micah made these prophecies. He lives during the reign of three different kings. So this could be done when King Ahaz is reigning. And at that time, there were lots of people that were picking at Judah, including the northern kingdom of Israel. They were attacking them. So it could have been then. It could have been given initially when Hezekiah was king. And you have the Assyrians that are bearing down on them. But regardless of who the specific enemy was at the time, Micah is giving this prophecy for the sake of the people who are going to go into exile, who are going to experience Babylon's attack and invasion. That's what he's writing this for. Because it's clear that he writes this from the standpoint of Jerusalem being defeated. That's what he describes. Jerusalem is defeated, and what the city of Jerusalem here is doing is they're telling their enemy who's been victorious, don't gloat. You should not rejoice over what's happened, because this isn't the end of the story. And there's these next two lines. It says, when I fall, when I sit. We could translate them as a number of other translations do. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. And the idea is, even though that's happened, even though Jerusalem and Judah, they're presently defeated, there's a victory that's coming. Even though the city's fallen, it's going to rise. Even though the people sit in darkness, and that's an image of like sitting in a dungeon. They're in captivity. That's the description here. Even though that's happened, the Lord is their light. And the way that's worded is, presently the Lord is their light. Even while they're in darkness, the Lord has already become their light. He's preserving them. And that's a truth that some of the Jewish people took hold of. They believed it. And we see that later on in other stories, like in Daniel. Daniel believed that the Lord was his light, even in darkness. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they believed that the Lord was their light, and they were able to keep going. Verse 9 describes the people of Jerusalem recognizing that they deserve what they've experienced. So they recognize that this captivity that they experience is deserved. They've failed to keep the covenant. So it describes it as God's punishment. It's the indignation of the Lord. Indignation is wrath, anger, fury. This is God's anger against sin. And that anger always results in punishment. They're saying, this is right. God's doing the right thing. He's the righteous judge. He's never going to overlook sin. Sin always will be dealt with. And that's what they're acknowledging. They acknowledge their sin. They acknowledge that they deserve this punishment. But they also know that that's not the end of their story. That after they experience this punishment, there's going to be a vindication. That they're going to be acknowledged as God's people. That they're going to receive salvation after they go through this punishment. That their salvation is going to take place through judgment. And the reality is that's always how God's salvation takes place. Through judgment. So Jerusalem, they're confident here. They're confident that God's going to take up their case. He has, as righteous judge, he has said, you're guilty. And he's punished them. But after he punishes them, he's going to become like their defense attorney. And he's going to plead their case. And he's going to show that they, in fact, are his people. And he's going to rescue them. So they're confident of that. They're confident that on the other side of this punishment, they're going to experience God's grace. So when you think about what they're experiencing, one of the reasons why they're confident that God is going to plead their case is because Babylon is a sinful nation. Who they're going to use, who God is going to use to punish Judah is sinful. They're sinners too. So Judah and Jerusalem, they recognize we are guilty. We're sinners. We deserve this punishment. But we are just as confident that the people that bring it about are going to experience that same thing. They're going to experience God's punishment. That's the amazing thing about God. When you see this, what he's doing here in Judah, is that God's in charge of this whole thing. He's in charge of using a sinful nation to punish his people. He's not sinful in doing that. And you can be completely assured that he's not going to let Judah get away with their, or Babylon rather, get away with their sin. And that's what Jerusalem is talking about here. So they have experienced this judgment, but they're confident that just like God had brought them out of Egypt, he's going to bring them out of this darkness. He's going to lead them into the light. He's going to give them salvation. Even though right now what they're looking at, what it describes them as gazing at, what they're gazing at right now is defeat, according to this prophecy. They're going to be gazing at, looking at, joyfully looking at their salvation. They're going to be able to look at it, and they're not the only ones who are going to see that. For us, when we look at what Judah's describing here and what Jerusalem, what they're saying here, we need to understand that this is how salvation takes place. That salvation takes place through judgment. That's very important for us to recognize. We understood that when we first came to faith, because we all understood that we deserved to be punished for our sin. We recognized that. We recognized that we were sinners. We deserve to be punished. The other thing that you see here is sin is personal. Very often today, you'll hear people talk about sin in a very impersonal way. Like it's a problem that we have to get around, or it's a problem that God has to get around. Sin is personal. Sin is something that I do. It's something that I deserve punishment for. It's not separated from me. It's not something that's not a part of my life. It's very intimately connected to me and what I've done and who I am. Sin is personal. And because of that, you see Israel, they say, I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned. So someone pays for someone's sin. It's personally paid for. It has to be a personal punishment, personal payment. Specific sin is being punished. You need to keep that in mind. Understand what's happening when Jesus comes. So what does the Bible say is our punishment for sin? It's death, right? Punishment for our sin is death. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. And death is the payment that we deservedly get. But it's not just that temporary reality, because Hebrews 9:27 points out that there is a judgment after death. So this death, even what's described in Romans 6:23, is an eternal reality. That what we deserve for our offenses against an infinite and eternally worthy God is an eternal punishment. So we have a problem then. I mean, if I face an eternal judgment, that means I'm always going to be paying for my sin. Because of who I've offended, because of who my sin is against, I'm never going to reach the end of that payment. That's why it was so important for the Messiah to be God. God the Father lovingly sent his Son, God the Son, who is also infinitely and eternally worthy. He stood in the place of sinners. He stood in my place. He paid for my specific sin on the cross so that my salvation comes through the judgment that fell on Christ. That's how I experience salvation, through his judgment. So the biggest question that you need to answer, and you want to answer this morning, is did Jesus take your punishment on the cross, or will you pay for your own sins someday? So let me tell you how I knew and how I know that he took my punishment. There was a day when I heard this message, and I'd heard this message a lot, but there was a day that I heard this message and I believed it. I knew I was a sinner. I didn't want to keep being a sinner. And I believed that Jesus had died for sinners. I know I believed that I was one of those sinners that he had died for. I believed that. And I trusted in that. The Bible teaches that, and we've seen this, that when people hear this message, not everyone responds that way. Not everybody believes that. And so the reality is, it also teaches that those who reject this, they will spend eternity paying for their sins. That Christ will not have paid for them on the cross. They will spend that time paying for their own sins. So how should you respond to the good news? You should respond the way that I did, the way that other believers have. You should recognize that you are a sinner who deserves this. Just like Judah, you recognize that your sin is worthy of punishment. Because of who you've sinned against, it's worthy of an eternal punishment. And you don't have to understand that, but you do need to recognize that you are a sinner, that you deserve that punishment. And you need to come to that, not looking at it impersonally, but saying, I don't want to keep living for me. I don't want to keep living my life my own way. And instead, you need to recognize what Jesus has done. And you need to believe that he died for me. You need to believe that he died for you, that he took your place. You need to believe that personally and to rest in that. He rose for you, he lived for you, he died for you, he rose for you. And I'd urge you to respond to that, to hear that, to believe that, to respond that way today, because you don't want to die and then face the judgment that exists after. You want to respond today. Now, if you are responding that way, we need to have confidence that this really is how our salvation takes place. We need to understand the significance of the cross for why that makes me saved. And the reason is because if we forget the cross, if we don't recognize that the cross actually shows us how bad our sin is, that the Son of God was crucified in our place, that tells us how bad our sin is. If we stop paying attention to that, then sin stops being that significant to us. It stops mattering to us. If we lose sight of the judgment that has to take place in order for us to be saved, we're not going to take seriously that judgment. We're not going to take seriously that sin. And we're not even going to take seriously the salvation. Because the reality is we were saved for a purpose. We were saved not simply to get out of that punishment. We were saved so that we would be what God always intended us to be. That we would live for the one who died for us. That's what 2 Corinthians 5:15 says. He died so that we would no longer live for ourselves, but live for him. That's why he died. So we need to focus on the cross so that we recognize, one, the significance of sin, that we want to avoid it, and that we recognize the significance of our salvation. So we need to be confident in salvation through judgment. We also must be confident in a historical salvation and judgment. Look at verse 10. Then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, "Where is the Lord your God?" My eyes will look upon her. Now she will be trampled down like the mire of the streets. It's, I think, easy for us to slip into this mode where Christianity is on the level of fairy tales and make-believe. We'd never say that. We wouldn't say that. But the reality is we look at the real world as certain things. The real world is going to work, paying your bills, figuring out how to pay for a car, how to pay for tuition. That's the real world. That's the world that I really live in. And Christianity is just really viewed as something that's happening in another world. At least the effects of it. It's just about what happens someday in the afterlife. That's kind of how we can think. So that's why it gets relegated. Religion and our pursuit of God gets relegated to just those times that we make time for it because we have to live in the real world. The idea that Christianity isn't a part of the real world is how, even when the Bible talks about salvation and judgment, we push it off to afterlife. Like it's something that happens not a part of the real world, but just after you die, where nobody can see. And when that happens, we can easily lose our confidence because we view the world like there's just two concurrent realities. There's what we're dealing with in our everyday lives, and then there's what happens someday when you die and nobody can see that. So it's easy to listen to the pressure from our world. So what you see here is salvation and judgment happening in the real world. That's what it's describing here. The last thing that verse 9 mentioned that Jerusalem was looking at was her vindication, her salvation. So there, she's looking upon her vindication, on what the Lord's going to do. And here she says that the enemy is going to do that too. The enemy is going to see her vindication. The enemy is going to see her salvation because they're going to experience a reversal. There's a little bit of, it obscures it a little bit in the ESV because it translates the same Hebrew word, look in verse 9 and see in verse 10. But those are the same words. They're looking at the same thing. They're seeing the same thing, which is important because the enemy is going to see this salvation, and that's what's going to cause her to be covered in shame. That's what's going to bring about the shame. She's going to see God's salvation and be ashamed. And look at what they've been saying. They've been saying, where is the Lord your God? They've been mocking them. Now they're not saying that anymore. Now they know the truth. God has been there the whole time. The Babylonians, they will have assumed we're more powerful. That's why we did this. That's why we were victorious. But in the end, they're going to realize, no, it wasn't that. God was using us. So they're pictured here. This reversal is pictured by what Jerusalem experiences. They get trampled. The Babylonians come in. And the picture here is like, you know, when there's a muddy, if you just see a bunch of soldiers go marching through a muddy field and all that you see left is just these muddy footprints. And it's just a field of muddy footprints. That's the description here. That's all that's left is what he's describing. So it's a complete reversal. That's what Israel experienced. Babylon came in and they conquered him and there's just a bunch of muddy footprints that were left over. And he's saying that's what they're going to see. They're going to look and see that same thing happen to Babylon, see that same thing happen in history. So the judgment that they were looking at here, they believe was going to happen in history. It was rooted in history. It wasn't something that was going to happen. They're not describing here something that happens after you die. They're describing something that happens in the real world. So again, what's the problem with viewing Christianity as though, well, you have the real world and then you have what happens after you die? Problem is, you're not confident. There are people around saying, where's the Lord your God? We say there's a God. They're saying, yeah, well, I don't see him. And there are people that reject that and they say, it's just, there's no evidence for what you believe in. They also have the tendency, every time the Bible speaks against something that the culture doesn't agree with, on matters of marriage or sexuality, they'll tell us we're on the wrong side of history. What they mean by that is, someday everybody's going to know that you guys were just putting your faith in this antiquated, ancient document with all these old and actually uncivilized beliefs. And one day you're going to be ashamed. That's the idea of being on the wrong side of history. So when people act that way, it's a lot harder to respond with confidence if you don't actually think in the end you're going to be seen by everyone to be on the right side of history. If you don't actually think that there's a real vindication that's happening, it's easy to wilt under the pressure. Nobody's going to see this, then I might as well just give in. But if they are going to see it someday, that gives you confidence. It gives you an incentive to keep going. If they will one day see that they were actually the ones on the wrong side of history, that gives you confidence not to give in when they give you that pressure, when they try to pressure you into giving in, living the way that they want you to live. So it's important for us to view salvation and judgment historically, that they're just as historical as the Revolutionary War and the moon landing. That they're going to happen in history. In the end, every knee is going to bow. We need to be confident of that. Otherwise, we will lose our nerve. When somebody pressures us, we're going to lose our nerve and give in. The problem that we face in the Christian world is that this kind of confidence isn't in vogue today. This is viewed as arrogance. People think that if you're confident, really that's too prideful. We shouldn't be that way. There are professing Christians that think that we should display more uncertainty. And the reality is, Paul tells us in Philippians 1:28 that this confidence comes from God. God grants us this confidence so that we won't give in to the pressure. It's not that we're not just confident because we think we're so smart. We're not confident because we think we've got it figured out. We know that we're not, according to 1 Corinthians, not the smartest, strongest, most royal, people. That's not the basis of God's choice for us. We are confident so we don't give in to the pressure. And it's a confidence that God gives us. So we need to be confident that when the Bible talks about salvation and judgment, it's going to happen in real time. It's going to be historical. It's going to be something where everybody sees it. We need to see that so that we don't give in when we feel the pressure. So we have to be confident in historical salvation and judgment. And we must be confident in a worldwide judgment. Look at verse 11 and 12. A day for building of your walls. A day for the building of your walls. In that day, the boundary shall be far extended. In that day, they will come to you from Assyria and the cities of Egypt, and from Egypt to the river, and from sea to sea, and from mountain to mountain. Let's just get something out of the way from the beginning. I just want to say that this verse has absolutely nothing to do with President Trump's desire to build a wall. And I would add that there is not a single verse in Scripture that is about that subject. And it's funny, but if you watch Facebook, there's some scary stuff going around on the interwebs. I mean, it makes me want to quit online. This is not talking about that. Nothing is talking about that. So what is it talking about? It's talking about a specific future salvation that he's been talking about. And there's two sides to it. On the one hand, it's talking about Jerusalem here, where the city is going to get expanded. And then it's also talking about this huge increase of inhabitants. So if you look at the territory, first, the territory that's expanded, it says that these walls are going to get built. And it's not the typical word for wall for a city. This is the kind of word that's used to describe stone fences that mark off farmland or mark off vineyards or keep sheep in a pen. I think the reason why he uses that here is because he's alluding already to Israel as a sheepfold. He's going to say in verse 14, shepherd your people. So he's already making that allusion. So I think it is talking about the city walls, but it's making an allusion to them as the people of God and saying that those walls are going to be expanded. And then it goes on to mention the boundary. And again, that's not actually the normal word for boundary, but he's trying to say that the city limits are going to be expanded, greatly expanded. In fact, the territory that God gave them initially is not the territory that they're going to end with in blessing. It's going to be greater than that, bigger than that. It's going to expand. And that idea is found other places too. In Isaiah, who was a contemporary of Micah, it says in Isaiah 26:15, but you have increased the nation, O Lord. You have increased the nation. You are glorified. You have enlarged all the borders of the land. So the inheritance that God promised Israel was going to be greater than that initial promise. It wasn't just going to be the land. It was going to be bigger than that. It was going to expand. In fact, Isaiah says that it's going to expand to an entirely new earth. That's what the blessing expands to. So the borders are not going to be the same. Here it's speaking of Jerusalem's expanding borders. Why did they need to expand their borders? Micah already said in chapter 4 that the Gentiles are going to come streaming into Jerusalem, and that's what he's talking about here. They're going to come from everywhere, from Assyria to Egypt, from Egypt to the Euphrates. That's poetic parallelism because Assyria is right around the Euphrates. So why does he mention Assyria and Egypt? Well, at the time that Micah wrote this, they're the world powers. So he's saying it's going to come from all the world powers. These people are going to come from sea to sea. They understood the world to kind of be surrounded by the sea. I mean, they were surrounded by the sea. So they're saying they're going to come from all over the world, from sea to sea. From the mountains, he says, to mountain. It could be translated from mountains to the mountain. And that could be talking about the other gods' mountains. You know, God is from, they have this understanding that God came to them, Mount Sinai. That's true. But that is the mountain, that is the God, and then there are these other mountains, like Mount Olympus. So it could be talking about these other mountains, these other peoples, they're going to come now to the mountain, or they're going to come to Mount Zion. Or it's talking about the mountains out there that surrounded the area, and it's, again, at the end of the day, what it's talking about is people from all over the world are going to come to this new Jerusalem. They're going to flood into Jerusalem. So what he's describing here is Jerusalem having to expand because of all these Gentiles flooding into Jerusalem. So what's he talking about? Well, I read where I think he's talking about. Revelation 21 talks about the same idea, that you have this massive city that has been expanded and the nations go into it. And its light is the Lord that was mentioned earlier in this chapter. Micah is giving us a snapshot of this end time reality where God is going to expand, vastly expand Jerusalem, not just for Israel. The nations are going to join in there. And he mentions this elsewhere too. The Lord mentions this in Isaiah again. Isaiah 19, 24 and 25 says, "In that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, 'Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance.'" Again, Assyria and Egypt, the world powers. It's just talking about the same thing. God is going to include them as his people too. So when Paul mentions that it's a mystery that the Gentiles are included in the people of God, we need to understand what he means. He's not saying that that wasn't in the Old Testament anywhere. It is. He's saying that they didn't understand how that was going to be. From Genesis all the way through, there are these points where God's saying, "I'm going to include the Gentiles," but he doesn't explain how. They didn't understand how God was going to include people who were non-Jewish as a part of his people without them becoming Jewish. They didn't recognize that. That was the mystery, that it was going to be in Christ. The truth is, the inheritance is now tied to Christ. He's the only one who deserves that inheritance, so that anyone who wants to be a part of that, whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish, it has to be connected to him by faith. So we are all heirs by faith. So what Micah is getting at here is this Gentile inclusion. He's talking about us. This is a reference to the inclusion of people from all over the world. This is what Revelation talks about, that one day some from every tribe and language and people and nation are going to be in this new Jerusalem. This is going to be what God is doing. We can be absolutely confident of this worldwide salvation. And why is that important? It's important for us to see these glimpses so that we know that we need to keep sharing the gospel, keep sending missionaries to the ends of the earth. We need to keep doing that. And not only should we do that, but we can be confident that it will be effective. Because one day, some from every people group is going to be a part of this faith. Now, does that mean that every individual missionary will be effective? No. Does that mean that it'll happen right away? No. William Carey waited 7 years to baptize one person. So it's not telling us that you can be absolutely certain if you go out there, share the gospel, people are going to come to faith. But it is encouraging us that we know in the end they do, that we're on the right track. And even though sometimes the world kicks back and says, "You need to leave these people alone. Now, this is a remote group of people. You need to stop messing with them. Let them live their own life in their own culture." No, we know that that's not right. That we have to continue to reach the lost. Every people group is going to be reached at some point. We should pursue that. We're right to pursue that. We need to keep our hand to the plow. So we need to be confident in that worldwide salvation, but we also need to be confident in a worldwide judgment. So look at verse 13. "But the earth will be desolate because of its inhabitants, for the fruit of their deeds." If we were to stop just at verses 11 and 12, be a lot more upbeat, be a lot more positive. It'd be a lot more like we get to all collect our participation trophies and everybody lives happily ever after. That'd be the kind of thing. That it didn't matter whether you believed or not, there's going to be this worldwide salvation, everybody gets along and it's all great. But it doesn't end that way. There are two realities. It's absolutely true. Jerusalem's going to be expanded. There are Gentiles from all these different people groups that are going to be included in God's people. But there's also another reality. There's also what happens to this present world and all those who reject this truth. It's described as experiencing complete devastation, described as desolate. This is a horrible end. That's maybe the best way to translate that. Horrible end that this results in. And why is that? Well, it explains why the earth meets with such a horrible end in those phrases that come after it. It has to do with the inhabitants. It's their fault. Now, this is not saying that it's their fault naturally, as though through nuclear holocaust or pollution we have made the earth desolate. That's not what it's talking about, because it says it's for the fruit of their deeds. This is describing a punishment. This is God's punishment. It's not happening naturally. It's not the result of mismanagement, although we have to be responsible with what God gives us. That's not why this happens. This is describing God's punishment of the earth. That's kind of hard for people to swallow today, though, because many people today look at humanity and see us as just one type of being on the earth. There's all these other types of beings. So the idea that God would destroy the planet because of one type of being doesn't seem to jive, because they kind of consider us as all equals. So why is it that one type of being is going to cause the devastation of the entire planet? Why is that? Well, when you look back at Genesis 1, it is very clear that the world's perception of humanity is wrong. That everything was created with a view to building towards humanity. Even the creation of the sun and the moon are described in a way to relate them to humanity. They're said they're given for appointed times, to mark off appointed times and days and years. So if that's true, and that's not the only thing that they were created for, but the point of Genesis 1 is to say that everything's building towards this pinnacle of creation, which is humanity, and everything in creation has been entrusted to humanity. And because of that, when humanity rebels against God and continues in their rebellion, the fate of the world is tied to their judgment. Because it was made for us, for his glory, but it was created the way that it was for human life. So that's why this destruction. The other thing we have to realize, though, is even though it's talking about the earth in its totality, it's not primarily talking about the earth. It's talking still about the people who are going to experience this. It's talking about the desolation they're going to experience, those that do not make it into this new Jerusalem. The reason is because God requires all sin to be punished. Sinners must be punished for every sin. Every sinner is punished for every sin. Every sinner, that is, who does not take refuge in the Son. So every sinner who doesn't take refuge in the Son will be punished. How do we respond to something like this? This last verse that talks about worldwide judgment. The first thing we do is to recognize what our job is and isn't here. Our job here in this world is not to right all the wrongs. That's God's job. Thankfully, my kids aren't in here. I'm not talking bad about them per se. Give a little bit of grain of salt here. But in my house, we are trying to make sure everybody understands their job description. So kids sometimes think that they take on the parent's job description with another sibling. We're trying to help them understand, no, that's not your job. You might be right, but that's not your job. Your job is to be the child. Your job is to be the sibling. And there's an equality, no matter what age, no matter if you came out 7 minutes before your sibling. Doesn't matter. You're on an even playing field. And your job is to politely tell the sibling, I don't like what you did. That wasn't fair. Would you please stop? If that doesn't work, you don't do the discipline. You go to the person who does the discipline. That's the same thing with us, though. We have to understand our role as people. We're not God, and we're not going to right every wrong. And not every wrong is going to be righted in our lifetime. And we have to make sure that we recognize that God is going to take care of it. He's going to take care of this. He's going to take care of the wrongs that we experience, that others experience. That doesn't make those wrongs any less severe, any less problematic, but he's going to take care of them, not us. We have to let that, we have to entrust those things to him to know that he is going to avenge the wrongs. That vengeance, in the right sense, belongs to the Lord, not to us. We need to have confidence that he is going to repay people. He is going to mete out justice. He's going to make sure that all the wrongs are righted. that we can leave that to him. And that's why it is important for us to see these truths. That in the end, judgment does come. So that we don't get upset and try to take that judgment and that writing into our own hands. That's not up to us. We can be sure that God is going to take care of it. Now, the other side of that is recognizing that there are a lot of people who are very confident that nothing's going to happen to them. They don't believe. They're living their own lives, and they're absolutely confident of that. One of the things that this shows us is we know they're wrong. And because of that, even though they're confident, and even though it might create some awkwardness, and even though it might even upset them, we know the importance of telling them the truth. Because we know what is going to happen. So we have to, we cannot open their eyes to this truth any more than we can give a blind person their sight. So that's not our job, but our job is to recognize that they are blind. And we're willing to risk awkwardness or anger to tell them the truth. We're willing to disrupt relationships to tell them the truth. I think the person who pointed this out better than most people was Penn Jillette. He's an atheist magician of Penn and Teller. Listen to what he said. He said, I have always said that I don't respect people who don't proselytize, people who don't try to get others to become Christians. I don't respect that at all. If you believe that there's a heaven and a hell and people could be going to hell or not getting eternal life, and you think that it's not really worth telling them this because it would be socially awkward. How much do you have to hate somebody to not proselytize? How much do you have to hate somebody to believe everlasting life is possible and not tell them that? I mean, if I believed beyond the shadow of a doubt that a truck was coming at you and you didn't believe that truck was bearing down on you, there's a certain point where I tackle you. And this is more important than that. This is an atheist who understands how unloving it is for Christians to keep this to ourselves. He says this because actually somebody shared with him and gave him Bible. And he said, I'm not offended in the slightest. And I don't understand people who are. He said, atheists out there who get offended at this don't get what's happening. They don't understand what the other person believes. And they should give them the benefit of the doubt. And we know that there's a worldwide judgment that is coming. And that should give us the confidence to tell people the good news. That should also put things in perspective and show us that it's not loving to keep that to ourselves. It's not loving to not tell somebody because we don't want it to get awkward. Or we don't want to risk ruining that relationship. There's something worse at the end that makes those things worth the risk. And we have the chance to see this truth now before it happens. And God's doing that to give us the confidence to open our mouth and be willing to ruin a relationship over the truth. Because of love. It won't always be received that way. But it is absolutely unloving and hateful to refuse to share that. If you know the truth, that means that we need to share the truth and warn people. We can't stop them. We can't open their eyes, but we can share that truth. Micah has done that. He's given us this window into the future. He's told us about this future judgment and salvation, and he's done that to give us confidence. He wants us to be confident that he's telling the truth. The Lord wants us to be confident that he knows the end from the beginning so that we'll believe him. And then that would give us confidence. So we need to be confident that this salvation takes place through judgment, that our sin matters. We need to be confident that this salvation and judgment is historical. It's going to happen in time and space. We need to be confident that this salvation and judgment are worldwide. It will impact everyone. No one is going to escape what's coming. And that is going to give us confidence now. Confidence in our future gives us confidence now. It gives us confidence to live our lives for Christ, to live our lives in a way that continues to reject sin, because we know that salvation occurs through judgment. We don't want to keep pursuing that sin. We want to follow Christ. We want to stand for Christ and his gospel and his kingdom. We'll see the seriousness of that sin. We're going to stand our ground then. If we see this and believe this, we're going to stand our ground when people tell us we're on the wrong side of history. We're going to say, I know you don't understand why I can't agree with you and affirm the things that you're affirming, but it would be cowardly for me to affirm that, to follow the herd because I'm a wimp and a coward. I can't do that. But it's only confidence in actually believing the word. It gives us the confidence not to hate sinners, but to not lie to them and say, you're okay. They don't want that. Especially the sinners that by God's grace recognize their sin and turn from it. They don't want you to lie to them. They want you to tell them the truth, not in a hurtful and hateful ways, but they want you to stand your ground. And this gives us the confidence to do that. It gives us the confidence to continue to push to the ends of the earth to reach the lost, even when people tell you, don't mess with that people group. We keep going. We have confidence because we know the truth. We see the end. We know that in the end, from every single people group will be reached. And we're given the confidence to risk awkwardness, to risk the disruption of a relationship in order to share the truth with them. Now, the way Paul describes that, he talks about being wise and to pray for wisdom, to pray for opportunities, and to season your words with salt. There is a way to do that that's not going to remove the awkwardness necessarily. It's not going to remove the anger that potentially comes. But also, you don't need to create anger and awkwardness where there didn't need to be any. So be wise about it, but risk that for the sake of the lost. Jesus really is coming back, just as truly and historically as he came the first time. And we need to believe that, and that does give us confidence. Let's pray. Father, naturally, we don't have this confidence. So ultimately, we are looking to you to provide it by your Spirit, through your word. But we need you to give us the confidence that your word is true, that this really is the end, that will happen, will take place. And we need your grace to give us the confidence to respond to it, to actually respond believing that this is true. And in our day-to-day lives, that is hard. Because we're so easily swayed by the fear of man. Pray that you would work in our hearts that confidence. That we would demonstrate it with humility. That it's not us coming up with this. That we are really submitting to what you say in your word. That we are not super smart people who have it all figured out. We are the people who have recognized that we don't have it figured out, and that's why we've gone to your word. So pray that you would grant us humility even as we display confidence in your word, confidence in you. Father, for anyone who does not know you this morning, who's heard these words, pray that you would open their eyes. Only you can do that. They would see the truth. That they need your grace. They need to respond to this good news. Jesus has come and lived and died and risen again for sinners. That they would believe that personally. That they would believe that today. Give us grace, Father, as we sing in response to your word, that we would sing with hearts that truly do believe. These words that we sing would be meant. In Jesus' name, amen.